This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week we got a whole slew of movies hitting wide release. I'm going to be trying to talk about all of them. Some I've seen, some I haven't. We'll be talking about Free Fire, Born in China, Unforgettable, The Promise, Phoenix Forgotten, and Their Finest. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup with a spotlight on the 1995 horror film Tales from the Hood. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First of all, I talked about last week. I said I wasn't going to talk about any Star Wars news because the Star Wars celebration in Orlando was going on throughout the weekend. So there was movie news developing throughout the weekend. So I said I'll talk about it now. What's so odd is there really wasn't any significant Star Wars news. I mean, there's little things like about Rebels, the series getting another season, and they debuted the trailer for The Last Jedi, which I'm going to be talking about in a little bit. But in terms of hard news about stuff that's going to hit the mainstream, we didn't really get anything, which is actually kind of cool, I find. The stuff people were most excited about were like sizzle reels or retrospectives or people talking about different characters or panels with like Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford together. And of course there was a tribute to Carrie Fisher. So there was a lot of stuff that happened that was really for the fans. And that's what Celebration has always been about. I actually find it kind of cool that there wasn't any big news aside from them showing the trailer for The Last Jedi. There was no developments in the Han Solo movie. There's no real development in any more spinoff movies, whether there's going to be an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie or anything like that. There was no further details about Episode 9, which of course I wasn't expecting because we've got Episode 8 coming up. And of course, there's going to be secrets and surprises in that. So I actually am kind of thrilled at seeing how much Lucasfilm just said, hey, let's make this for the fans so they can enjoy it. So, you know, good job, Disney, on that one, because that's who's keeping Star Wars going. That's who kept Star Wars going between the films. That was what was kept it going before they did the special editions, when you had the role-playing games and the comics and the tie-in novels. And that's what kept it going after the prequels from 2005 on, before Disney took over Star Wars and actually said they're going to make more movies. But there were a couple odd little pieces of news that came out. Well, the first one is probably the most 2017 type of news that I could think of just kind of a wackadoodle, face-palming, oh my God, you can't be serious. Supposedly, you know, of course, Disney's remaking all these movies. They're remaking the animated films. They did Beauty and the Beast just recently, broke box office records. Of course, they did Jungle Book last year, and they're going to be doing The Lion King, and they've got Mulan, and they've got all this stuff in the works, and they got Aladdin. And a lot of people have kind of buzzed about the fact that, well, the problem with doing any sort of remake of Aladdin is, how do you top Robin Williams as a genie? I mean, if you can't have somebody do better than Robin Williams, so you either have to have them imitate Robin Williams, which you never get the same thing, or they'd have to be wholly different. Well, the rumor is Will Smith is being courted for this role. And it's Guy Ritchie who's directing this. You know, of all the Disney remakes, I think they're cool and all. I don't have a whole lot of bad things. Even like Tim Burton doing Dumbo. But my God, Guy Ritchie doing Aladdin and then throwing Will Smith? Because Shark Tale was such a great movie. If you didn't understand my facetious nature, Shark Tale's terrible. But Will Smith, first of all, we're about 10 years too late to get Will Smith as the hip genie. And I'd rather have them do Stephen Wright. So that's ridiculous. That also came out with some news that Coming to America 2 is being developed. And how could that go right? You got Eddie Murphy, you got Arsenio Hall. John Landis, who, has he done a good movie in 20 years? I mean, this is going to be like Blues Brothers 2000. And then finally, this little piece of weird news hit the mainstream this week. People love to hate Adam Sandler. And what's funny is you almost never hear people review movies that premiere on Netflix, with the exception of like Mystery Science Theater last week when I talked about it, where it's that big of a deal. You don't see people reviewing direct to Netflix movies, which they kind of should, because there are some that are legitimate releases. But the one that you always tend to see reviews on are Adam Sandler's movies, because people love to hate Adam Sandler. Now, here's the thing. I don't hate Adam Sandler. I hate the string of movies he's done in the last 10 years or so. I mean, stuff like Jack and Jill and That's My Boy and the Grown Ups movies are all just awful. I have to admit, I watched The Ridiculous Six, and it's not a good movie, but I didn't hate it. It was a juvenile, stupid film. But I mean, I liked his earlier stuff like Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. But there was a news article that came out that basically said that Netflix users have watched 500 million hours of Adam Sandler movies. 500 million man hours have been wasted collectively on Adam Sandler movies on Netflix alone. This is not talking about going back and watching Billy Madison on DVD. This is through Netflix streaming, which I find horrifying because, you know, it's good for him. I mean, I hear he's a great guy and a nice guy. So good that he's got a cottage industry. It's bad for entertainment because this is garbage entertainment, but I'm okay if people like garbage entertainment, let them watch garbage. I mean, nobody's complaining because The Real Housewives of whatever is getting that many viewers. So why not let Adam Sandler have his garbage too? But I find it so funny how many people are upset by this. People get over it. There's way more things to be worried about and upset about in the world. Even forget entertainment and movies. I mean, Guy Ritchie directing Will Smith in Aladdin is way more distressing to me than Netflix users wasting 500 million man hours watching Adam Sandler. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I'm only going to play one trailer this week, and there's a reason for that. And I did this the last time a Star Wars movie, when Episode 7 was coming out. When that trailer dropped, I played a longer trailer, because here's the thing. When it comes to Star Wars, I insulate myself. I do not want spoilers. And the industry is so spoilery, and trailers are so spoilery. I said to myself, you know what? I'm not going to watch it. And people are going to ask me about it. I said, I'm not going to watch it. I'm going to try and stay pure. So when it comes time for December to watch the new Star Wars movie, I don't have half the movie spoiled by seeing what happens in the trailer. But I figure the teaser a year ahead of time, or at this point, what, like 8 months ahead of time, is fine. So this is Star Wars The Last Jedi teaser that premiered at Celebration last weekend, opening on December 15th.
What do you see?
Light. Darkness. The balance.
A whole lot in this trailer, which is cool. I mean, it's good because it doesn't give you any sense of what the story is and no sense of what the conflict is. You know that Rey is training with Luke, and apparently Luke's the grumpy old man now. He doesn't like the Jedi, and maybe it's just because his nephew went to the dark side. Maybe it's just that he's a bad trainer. And that happens also in the books. He fails at training the Jedi, and there's a reason why Yoda was a Jedi master. He'd been doing it for 800 years. So Luke couldn't just pick it up in his 30s. So I think there's some things that look cool. I think that the new ships look good. I love the idea that in these new movies, they're putting the ships in the planet's atmosphere. So it's not all space battles, but it looks cool and it looks authentically Star Wars. And it's great to see Daisy Ridley. I mean, I just wish she'd change her outfit, for crying out loud. Could you imagine how bad that outfit smells by the end of The Force Awakens? And then she goes out to this island with nothing else but a knapsack and a lightsaber, and she's in the same outfit. Do people not have body odor in the Star Wars universe? I guess not. Anyways, this looks cool. I'm looking forward to it. It's a Star Wars movie. It's going to be a highlight of December. Can't wait. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. And when I come back, I'm going to be talking about Born in China and Free Fire. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the latest Disney Nature movie, and that is Born in China. This Disney Nature documentary looks at the life of Chinese wildlife, including pandas, monkeys, and the elusive snow leopard.
Disney Nature proudly invites you to its most ambitious film yet. Groundbreaking journey inside the breathtaking wilds of China.
This film, I think, is groundbreaking in the sense that it really gives the audience a view into China that we don't see.
I actually love the fact that Disney's doing these nature movies, because this takes me back to the time during the Wonderful World of Disney in the evening, or you just see these nature documentaries that Disney did in the 50s and 60s. And they were really great, wonderful stuff, because Disney has always tried to be a family-friendly company. And I think nature documentaries are one of the best things in terms of science education, because once you get to a certain age, you don't watch like educational shows anymore. And to be fair, there's not a whole lot of great science education in educational shows. A lot of the educational shows are about preschool stuff like Dora the Explorer, which teach you patterns and sequences and problem solving, which is great. Or they're like learning how to spell and read and write or speak a different language. This is about science. And yeah, it's contrived. You see a lot of the same stuff in these movies. They creep in. You see elements from the other Disney nature movies like Chimpanzee or African Cats or Monkey Kingdom. You see a lot of this stuff repeated, because they go and they shoot, you know, hundreds of hours of footage, and then they kind of cobble together a story, and, you know, the narrative's a little bit forced. And you see a lot of the same tropes show up, like in the monkey section. There's a scarred outsider who had a confrontation with one of the leaders. And of course, we saw that in Monkey Kingdom already, and we also saw that in African Cats. So you also see the thing where one of the families, the snow leopards, are chased from their territory by a competing group. And again, we saw that with African Cats. We saw that with Chimpanzee. We saw that with Monkey Kingdom. So it gets a little repetition if you've seen enough of these movies, but still, you know, it works because it's trying to put together a certain narrative, because it's a G-rated movie and it's for little kids. So it's not a hardcore, absolutely everything that happens documentary, but it's a great introduction to watching something about science. And with that said, it does have the awe factors off the charts. So much so, you know, you go see this that first week, and Disney will donate to the World Wildlife Fund. So if you want to, you know, kind of like save the planet or whatever, go and you spend your money to go see this movie, and they're going to donate a portion of ticket sales, which is also a nice thing. And the other thing about these movies is they don't make a ton of money. I mean, when you look at the cash cows that Disney has with Pixar and Marvel and Star Wars, these things are a drop in the bucket. But I love the fact that Disney still does them, because it ingratiates its audience to the Mouse House. But with that said, going to see it in the theaters can be a little bit frustrating, because, like I said, the awe factor is off the chart. And, you know, like, I went and saw it. I took my 8-year-old, and he had a blast watching it. He enjoyed it. He liked seeing the cute animals. But then there are these two women behind, and women, I mean, it would have been one thing if they were, like, 5-year-old kids. They were grown women. And this is, I'm going to replay the trailer, and this was what it was like sitting behind them. Oh.
Disney Nature proudly invites you.
Oh, bless your heart.
To its most ambitious film yet.
It's adorable. Oh. Oh.
Journey.
All right, I have to stop the trailer, because I can only take so much of that. That's what I had to deal with. It was so frustrating because they didn't even have kids with them. And I wanted to say to them, to quote the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman from Punch Drunk Love.
Shut up! Will you shut up? Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!
Yeah. So one of the problems with seeing these movies in the theater, especially if it's a packed theater, you get some idiots around. You get the people who go see a movie with their kids and then they talk to their kids through the whole movie. Like the kid's not capable of watching a 79-minute film on their own. And if your kid's that stupid or has that short of an attention span, you're parenting wrong. But with all that said, with the annoyance of certain people in the audience, you know, Born in China is a beautiful movie. It's gorgeously shot, like all the Disney nature stuff. And you learn a little bit about pandas. You learn a little bit of snow leopards. You learn a little bit about these monkeys. And it also gives a nice look at the natural world. It also shows some less adorable parts of nature. It's still G-rated and it's not horribly violent, but snow leopards gotta eat. So you're going to see a little bit of that. But I think they handle it extremely well. They've always handled the more gruesome side of nature in these Disney nature films quite well. So I'm going to have to say, you know, Born in China, like all the other Disney nature movies, rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Free Fire. In the 1970s, a small-time arms deal goes horribly awry as both sides get into an extended shooting match with each other.
There he is.
Thousand apologies. Hate it when people are tardy. It's good to meet you boys. Thanks for coming out.
Let's buy some guns, eh?
You're on a different level now. The guy who represents this merchandise?
Check out the merch.
That's not what he ordered.
He ordered M16s, different weapon.
You want the weapons or you don't want the weapons?
Here we go. Oh, now we're cooking!
This is directed by Ben Wheatley, and he's best known, he's a British director, and he's best known for movies like Kill List, and he did High Rise a year or two ago, which was arguably science fiction horror. It was, it pushed the boundaries and it strained its plot a bit to try and keep the story going. But he's always been a bit of a fringe director. He's not a mainstream guy. And it sort of like reminds me of what it was like when Trainspotting 2 came out. In order to do Trainspotting 2 and be true to the original film, you couldn't make something that the mainstream could watch because Trainspotting's not mainstream. And it never has been. And so by getting like, Danny Boyle back and Ewan McGregor and Ewan Bremmer and Robert Carlyle, and you ended up with a Trainspotting sequel that fit with Trainspotting, but not a whole lot of people wanted to go see it because Trainspotting's a niche movie. And I feel that's the same way with this. There's a certain attempt to do Quentin Tarantino with this movie because it's a lot of hyperbolic characters in one situation, sort of like a bottle episode of the TV show. It's a lot of dialogue and it's interplay between the characters, which is quite fun to watch. And there's quite a few of them. And then, of course, a lot of violence erupts. Some people are comparing it to Reservoir Dogs. The big difference is Reservoir Dogs, there's scenes elsewhere other than the warehouse and Reservoir Dogs because they've got the diner and then they got the flashbacks to him training. So as much as everybody wants to think Reservoir Dogs is a self-contained one-building movie, it's not. This one is. They're driving to this drop, and they get there, and the whole thing happens. So it's a contained movie, and it feels, at times, a little bit nihilistic, which is very typical of Ben Wheatley. And it's heavy with the crime, and heavy with the violence, and heavy with the language. I found it entertaining. It can get a little tedious, simply because, like I said, there's not much to the story. It's not really a character development or plot-driven film because it's just arms deal gone wrong, but it's just kind of fun to watch, you know, these hornets in a jar shaking up, shooting at each other. And then you got ridiculous performances by, like, Charlton Copley. Cillian Murphy's good. Brie Larson's kind of squandered a bit. She's not great in the movie, but, like, Armie Hammer's actually really good. So I enjoyed it for what it is. I think it's just outside of the mainstream enough to make it work. So I'm going to have to say Free Fire kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Unforgettable, The Promise, and Phoenix Forgotten. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next three films are going to be crammed into this one segment, and mainly because I didn't see any of them. It's really not my fault. I have to admit that every now and then, it used to happen quite often. You know, you'd have the entirety of spring where the movies in January through April were kind of garbage. And the industry was just basically buying time until the summer where they could release the tentpoles. And then you'd have the fall in August and September and into October be kind of garbage, and it was just the industry waiting to release the big movies at Christmas. So you basically had two seasons of movies. But over the years, these movies are trickling out all over the calendar, and we've seen that in the last couple of years. Last year, we had Batman vs. Superman as a huge release in March, and just this year, we had Beauty and the Beast as a huge release in March. You have Fast and Furious, which is a huge release in April. We had 50 Shades of Grey. You had Deadpool as huge February movies. So the tentpoles are being spread all over the calendar now. But you still get these pockets of weeks where there's really nothing out, but there's a lot of movies. And the industry is just dumping a bunch of films out that they don't think have a lot of power or impact between tentpoles, because you had Fast and Furious last week, and in a couple weeks you got Guardians of the Galaxy. So you got this two-week period where, which used to be like 3 months, but you got this two-week period where they say, oh, we can sneak a lot of movies out here. And that's essentially what happens. These are movies that they don't screen for press, or they screen very limitedly for press, and then they have no confidence behind, and they don't even have Thursday night screenings for some of these. And it makes sense, because these are usually pretty awful films. Let's talk about the first one. No screenings whatsoever on Thursday night. I couldn't even see this early if I wanted to, and that was Unforgettable. Katherine Heigl stars as a disturbed woman who targets the fiancé of her ex-husband.
Emily.
Say bye to mommy.
Bye, sweetheart.
You'll get used to Tessa.
She's adjusting, too. Lost out,
beat up. I know she's Lily's mother, and of course I respect that, but it feels like I'm stepping into her life.
It's not easy, all this change.
I get it.
No, you don't.
You should never have brought her here.
I'm done with crazy.
You gave it all to her, right in front of me!
What happened to Katherine Heigl? She had the most promising career when she was younger. She was doing the independent horror movies, and then she did Grey's Anatomy, and that really put her on the map. And then suddenly it's like, hey, she's going to be the new big star. They put her in like Knocked Up, and then she started doing her own romantic comedies and had a certain degree of success, and then she just fell apart. And I had heard that part of it was her mother had become her agent, essentially, or her manager. Then she just disappeared. She stopped doing them. I mean, she showed up in a couple, but you could see that the industry was no longer putting her as the starring role and expecting it to really make any money whatsoever. And now she's back in Unforgettable, which looks like a cookie cutter Lifetime movie of the week that's been transferred to the big screen. And Rosario Dawson plays the new girl in this, the fiance of her ex-husband, the one she targets. And it's kind of a shame to see Rosario Dawson, because I thought her career was better, because, I mean, you know, it's clear Heigl's on the skids. The only thing that makes it a little bit different is the last couple movies like this were all sort of geared towards a black audience, because they had that one No Good Deeds with Taraji P. Henson and Idris Elba. And then they had that one, A Perfect Man with Michael Ealy, and I forget who the woman was in, maybe Sana Latham. I can't remember. They had that one with Beyonce and Idris Elba. That was quite a few years ago. I forget what they are, but there's been a whole series of these basically domestic violence films, the Fatal Attraction type movies, but they've always kind of had an African-American cast. Oh, no, they've got Rosario Dawson, but it looks like it's trying to mainstream this, but I don't think it's going to work. This thing looks terrible. Katherine Heigl looks terrible. This whole movie looks like a disaster. So they didn't show it. I don't want to see it. I think it's probably going to get a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quick about Phoenix Forgotten. On the 20th anniversary of the mysterious Phoenix Lights, footage is discovered about missing teens from that fateful night.
The Phoenix Lights flew southeast, which is exactly where we're headed.
How do we get there?
Are you serious? It's like what? 6 a.m.
Literally nothing out here.
I know that you are still alive. Please come home.
I shouldn't have brought you guys out here.
I remember the Phoenix Lights. I am pretty sure I will never remember this movie. First of all, it's found footage. I'm so done with found footage. And I love seeing the fact that found footage is getting dumped into garbage slots. It's still a gimmick and people are still trying to use it, but it's not a moneymaker anymore. People aren't falling for it as a gimmick. And that's great because it's a stupid gimmick. And then on top of it, this is using antiquated video equipment. This is making it look like Blair Witch. But you look at this trailer and it looks like every other found footage movie. Shaky cam, yelling, turning on and off the camera, technical noise and tracking problems. And you just looks like you got scared people in the woods, at least in the, although this is Phoenix, so it's rocks, I guess. You don't really have woods, not the way you do like in, where was it, Maryland, that Blair Witch Project was taking place. This looks derivative and it looks completely forgettable. So unforgettable looks like it's forgettable. Phoenix Forgotten looks like it's going to be completely forgotten. And it also gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's do The Promise. This love story is set against the backdrop of the Armenian genocide in World War I and features a love triangle as the Ottoman Empire collapses.
Christopher Myers.
Chris is a star reporter for the Associated Press.
A toast to old friends and new.
It's very dangerous for Armenians right now. I want to get you out of here.
If it's not safe for me, then it's not safe for any of my people.
What is the Associated Press doing here?
Reporting on the war.
There is no war here.
A couple weeks ago, I reviewed The Ottoman Lieutenant, which I was kind of like, look, you know, I think I gave it a kind of sucked. And mainly because it was this crappy little love story that felt like it came out of a romance novel that wasn't very good. Apparently, and I didn't realize this until later I was reading, and I don't know history. I'm going to tell that. I mean, I've heard of the Armenian genocide. I don't know the politics and the history around it, but apparently that takes place around the same time. And I've heard that a lot of critics with Ottoman Lieutenant said, hey, they're sort of glossing over the Armenian genocide. Well, I had heard what had happened was there was this movie, The Promise, that we're talking about now, was made for like $100 million. It stars Christian Bale and Oscar Isaac, two big names. And it got limited screenings, but then suddenly it was getting hammered on IMDb ratings because apparently Armenian Holocaust deniers were voting it down. And then Armenians got online and started voting it up. So it's either got 1 star or 10 stars, depending on which side of history is trying to remember this. And this other movie, The Ottoman Lieutenant, was mostly funded by Turkey, which has a much softer view of the Armenian genocide because that's the country that engaged in that. The bad thing is it looks like both these movies are not very good. They look like they're both crap. So people are fighting over not very good movies, and I feel bad for any Armenians who want to have their story told because I don't think it's getting told by either movie. This one is trying to talk about the genocide, but it looks like it's kind of the same kind of movie where it's this romance, and it looks like this mixture of between that Ottoman Lieutenant movie and A Bitter Harvest, or I reviewed recently about the genocide in the Ukraine. Where the starvation of all the people by Stalin, it looks like it's kind of just a mix of those two, which none of those movies were very good. And when it comes down to The Promise, I tried to get a screener of it. I contacted directly the publicist and like, we're not doing screeners. I'm like, well, guess what? Your movie's not getting reviewed then. I'll talk about it, but I'm going to tell people that they didn't want critics to see it. And because of that, it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. Sorry for the non-reviews, but let's move on. We got another movie to review in the next segment, which is Their Finest. I'll also talk about the weekly box office and the home cinema roundup. Because we can! Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's continue on with the final movie review, which is Their Finest. In the middle of the London Blitz during World War II, a married woman falls in love with a fellow screenwriter as they develop a film about the Dunkirk evacuation.
Welcome to the Ministry of Information Film Division.
Mr. Churchill is persuaded that film can show that this is a war America should be fighting.
If we're to capture the public imagination and their trust, we need a story to inspire a nation.
Dunkirk, the evacuation of troops trapped by the German advance.
It's very good.
We know how it starts.
Twin sisters took their father's boat over to join the rescue.
We know how it ends.
338,000.
Home safe. Now all we have to do is fill in the gaps.
It's gotten some good reviews, and it stars Gemma Arterton, who I've always had a thing for. I've always liked her. She, of course, played a Bond girl in Quantum of Solace. She's the main character. It's about her, and she has this relationship with this artist, and they're married, but he's trying to do his thing, and she has to get a job, and so she starts writing for the Ministry of Information, which is kind of the propaganda arm of the British government. I mean, it's not as hardcore propaganda as some movies that were made during World War II, but it was more for sort of like, you know, rah-rah and getting the people in the support of the war, which is what makes it propaganda. But since it was the Allies, it was good propaganda. But it shows her relationship with the screenwriter, her struggle to become respected in there, but also just this interesting little behind the scenes of this film that they're trying to do. And the interesting characters she runs into, like Bill Nighy plays one of the actors, and he's great. I love Bill Nighy. Eddie Marsden plays Bill Nighy's agent, and he's kind of funny in the movie. And they've got, of course, the director, and they've got the bosses, and they've got the Minister of Information, all trying to do this. But at the same time, you know, even though there's a war going on, you get this a lot with British movies because they, of course, dealt with the war firsthand. But what this does is it takes it away from the front lines. It's not about soldiers in the war. It's about people who are just sort of still trying to live their lives in the city. But they're not completely safe from danger because there's bombing raids and they have them going underground into the London Underground. And there are times buildings that completely blow up. And you know, people are really in danger, even just the everyday people in an everyday city, which you understand why they sent all the kids up north at that time. And that's kind of what I appreciated. I appreciated it being an interesting perspective on the war without being preachy about it. It was just because it was Britain. It's a British movie, and that's kind of one of the things Britain had to deal with. It also serves as that love story, but it also serves as a bit of a feminist piece because it's her trying to get respected for what she does. Because it's guys trying to write in. Of course, it was very macho back in the 40s, so they couldn't write for the women, and they would bring in female screenwriters to get the females' voices right. And it's a charming little movie. It's something you would have watched with your mom on PBS. That's kind of what it reminds me of. So it's not for the, you know, it's not meant to be lickety split. It's not going to draw from the Fate of the Furious audience, but it's the kind of movie I'd recommend to my mother. And overall, I thought it was good. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. I overestimated the Fate of the Furious. I said it was going to make about $125 million for the weekend. It actually underperformed. It came in under $100 million. Which, look, I mean, making $99 million or opening weekend for a film, that is nothing to sneeze at. So don't think that they're at any point going to be struggling. Now, yes, the movie did cost $250 million to make, but the flip side is it broke the box office record for the highest gross worldwide for a weekend. It like topped Star Wars, The Force Awakens by like $10 million. It made like $10 million more its opening weekend. So it's halfway to $1 billion already. So it's more than made up. It's $250 million budget, but it a little underperformed a little bit. And I'm not surprised. And maybe this franchise is waning a bit in America, but you know, hey, the Transformers franchise is waning a bit. I'll bet you anything this new Transformers movie is going to struggle to make $75 million its opening weekend. It's not going to make $100 million. They cooked the books just to get the $100 million opening a couple years ago when the fourth one came out. So I don't think you're going to get the $100 million opening for Transformers, but they still do so incredibly well overseas that that more than makes up for it. So Fate of the Furious is doing fine. The next couple ones, like Boss Baby, came in second with like $16 million, which is a huge stretch. I mean, that's what, like $80 some million between the number one and number two, and then Beauty and the Beast. Then everything else was in the $2 to $6 million range. Tommy's Honor was about $200 million. Spark, oh my God, it didn't come close to the top 10. It came in at number 27 with 116,000. This week, I think Fate of the Furious is still going to do well. It's probably going to be good for about 45 million, between 40 and 50 for sure. And everything else is going to be under 10 million. Unforgettable, conventional wisdom says that that's probably going to do the best because that kind of will command the most secure audience. But it just feels like such a trash movie. Just, people may not be interested in seeing Katherine Heigl anymore. I'd be surprised if any of these make over 5 million. Now, maybe Born in China will make between 5 and 10 because it's got a good solid audience, family films. And, you know, who knows? Maybe Free Fire might make some, but the R rating and sort of the fringe side is going to be a little bit of a tough sell. Everything else, I mean, I don't even think Phoenix Forgotten is going to get in the top 10. And The Promise, I think, is going to tank. It doesn't matter who's in it. So, yeah, it's kind of a disappointing week for box office. And it'll be the same thing next week, I'm sure. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Tales from the Hood. It comes out as a collector's edition Blu-ray from Shout Factory, or rather Scream Factory. That's their genre market. Three inner city youths wander into a creepy mortuary where the caretaker tells them various tales of horror.
Let's roll, bud.
In this neighborhood is a house where souls never rest. You're invited to share their secrets.
I've been waiting for you boys.
You're invited to share their tales.
Unless, of course, you're scared.
Tales of madness. Ah! Of revenge.
The dolls don't want you there. They want reparation.
Of horror.
I remember when this came out, and I think it was 1995. And I never saw it in the theater. I either watched it on HBO or I had gotten the VHS. My sister and I watched it. And I don't remember it being very good. One thing I do remember is it features David Alan Grier in a part. And up until that point, David Alan Grier had either played kind of the dorky, preppy nerd or straight up comedy. But he plays a very serious character. He plays an abusive father in this movie, and he's actually really good. It's the first time I noticed, I'm like, oh God, that guy can actually act. He just doesn't do comedy. He can act. But at the time, I mean, it had a lot of the, you know, black cinema names behind it. Spike Lee was one of the producers of it. And it's got Clarence Williams III as the mortuary dealer. And of course, you've got people like Rosalind Cash and Joe Torre's in it. I mean, you've got some names from the time. What was interesting about this is it holds up better than it did. This was back in the mid-90s where it was so heavy-handed with social justice in movies and meanings and messages. This movie, all the anthology sections of them, each feature a different social issue. You know, one of them's about gang violence. The other one's about domestic violence. One of them's about reparations for slavery. One of them's about police brutality. So they each kind of cover a different social issue, which was a little annoying in the 90s, but it works better now. And it's, these are actually some pretty scary little horror stories. These are effective for what they are, and especially for this sort of portmanteau type of anthology, it really works. I mean, it's something that, like I said, it's rare to find a movie, especially from the 90s, that holds up better than it did when I first saw it. But this one does. It's worth revisiting if you've seen it. It's, it works as a genuine horror story, but it also works as a significant movie that addresses issues that were especially for the African-American community back in the day. Now, there are some new special features. There's a vintage special feature, a vintage behind the scenes look at the movie. But there's also a new one, which is a making of, and there's interviews with the writers and the director and some of the actors. And finally, there's an audio commentary and the theatrical trailer. So it has some nice stuff on there, kind of being brought back out of the vault. And it's always great. Scream Factory or Shout Factory does a lot of these, what would otherwise be forgotten films? And it's nice to see them collecting some of these really cool genre pieces in their library. So I'm going to have to say that Tales from the Hood kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The other ones this week, we've got Split, which is, of course, the one from M. Night Shyamalan, The Founder, starring Michael Keaton as Ray Kroc, and Sleepless, which stars Jamie Foxx in a terrible cop movie. That is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about maybe The Circle, How to Be a Latin Lover, and Slight. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.